So let me get started by introducing our host for tonight's event. Zoe Clark is Michigan Radio's program director, our resident political junkie, and also the co-host of It's Just Politics with somebody else up here. And so without further ado, Zoe Clark.
Hi, everyone. Good evening. Good evening. And Rick Pluta, to my right, physically speaking, of course, not politically speaking.
Well, we don't typically go there, but I live in Lansing and she does live in Ann Arbor.
Again, I want to thank Jeff Williams and everyone at Public Sector Consultants, as well as Susan Demas. To my far left, maybe that is a fair. Susan Demas is the owner, editor, and publisher of Inside Michigan Politics. If you don't read it, you absolutely should. So we are very excited because this is kind of the first post-pundit summit that we've done, Michigan Radio, Public Sector Consultants, Inside Michigan Politics, and we are also super thrilled to my left also. Stu Sandler, ranked one of the five most important, five best Republican strategists in Michigan. So you made this all happen.
Out of how many?
Out of six.
Five. So I want to start with
well,
Jeff.
Well, first of all, we just want to thank all of you for coming. Because we know that you could have gone to Hamilton tonight, but you decided to
boycotting Hamilton.
And everyone come be in this, with us. So thanks for
everyone in
thanks
this room
for
had
here.
Tickets. Yeah, Jeff, you did some homework. Out of the rest of us, we all have beer. You have like a notebook, and you have this. So let's take a look at this that you all have.
So
in
if
your
everyone
seat.
In the audience will pull out their number two pencils.
But seriously, when we were putting this event together, I think it's probably fair for most of us to say that we weren't expecting an outcome that we did see on Tuesday night. Stu, maybe you feel differently. What happened as a Republican strategist in Michigan? What went right for you?
Sure. Well, you know, once the and I know the Clinton campaign has singled out the Comey letter, but I will tell you that once that sort of Comey announcement about the FBI possibly having an additional investigation against Hillary Clinton came out, we started seeing spiked numbers in the Republican numbers. The Friday before the election, we actually were told by the Republican National Committee that, wow, Michigan's in play. And we saw it the whole week, but by the Trump people and the RNC, they said, yeah, no, we're seeing some real shifted numbers here. And it's kind of played out over the weekend. It really did. It was a little surprising. One of the things was I was kind of mired in Oakland County, and the numbers weren't as good for Trump. Trump actually lost it by about the same amount that Romney did. So I said, well, he might get close. I'm not sure he's going to win here, but he might have a good night. But it really bared out that rural out county, yeah, and blue-collar areas turned out in a big way, and urban voters didn't come out for Clinton.
I have a question, which is that one of the things that seemed to have made the pollsters so wrong in this cycle was all of these rural voters who had not participated in a few cycles, but some pollsters had the idea that it was time to go and talk to them again. Who had that idea and why?
Well, if you look at the Michigan polling, it was pretty accurate. There were a lot of pollsters. Epic MRA was one that came out that showed a 4-point race, but a 13% undecided. There was another, John Yob from Strategic National had a poll showing it tied. Even, I'm blanking on the exit poll, but there was an exit poll, I think it was Target Insight, that had 48-48. So the polling in Michigan was fairly accurate. And one of the things I've seen in this cycle and in 2012 is that a lot of times voters actually tell you the story. It just depends on the pollster listening. Because in 2012, I had an exit poll. I had a tracking poll, which was done for me the day before on a race I was working on. And statewide, it said, well, if the likely voter model happens, Mitt Romney's tied with Obama. But if the registered voter model happens and the people saying they'll vote, he'll lose by 9 points. We don't really believe this one because there are a lot of people here saying that they're voting and we don't believe it. So we're going to go with the likely voter model. Well, it was dead on the registered voter model of the people who said they were coming out. Same thing here. Voters, there were 0 of 4 voters, people who haven't voted in the last 4 elections, who basically said, no, I'm going to vote out and this is why. And they actually came out. So I think if you look at some of the Michigan pollsters, they pretty much nailed it.
And Susan, these voters in Michigan, it was sort of the comeback of the rural voter. How surprised were you as results were coming in as a political pundit who was watching it come in? At what point did you realize what was going to happen? And how surprising was it?
Well, I was actually on TV down in Detroit with the Detroit News pollster milling around, Rich Chuba. And as I was waiting to go on and I was seeing the numbers, it really wasn't tracking with what the Free Press was saying. And it really looked like it was hitting the danger zone. In a way, it was fairly similar to the March 8th primary where, okay, you keep seeing the numbers come. You're expecting Detroit to come in to save Clinton. And the other side of the coin is that a lot of those people didn't show up.
Mm-hmm. So, Jeff, let's go to your homework and to your map. This is what
happened. We have to show this binder to everyone. So the last time I've seen a binder this thick, it was Brooks Patterson's Dirty Jokes.
Seriously, he does have a binder of dirty jokes.
I am a pointy-headed policy researcher. It's what we do. But I also thought, recognizing this as radio, but I brought some pictures. Some pictures really help, I think, show what happened in this election. So three stories. One is, if you look at the big map on the back, there are two versions of this. One was all voters, all counties. This is a drill down where we only look at those counties where 75% or more of the population is white and does not have any college up through graduate degree. So basically, we're looking at that white kind of working class vote. If you squint, in Utah, there is a little arrow that goes blue, but otherwise it's looking like mosquitoes landed on the Midwest and drew blood. So yeah. This shows you when we talk about that the Midwest collapsed for the Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
This is a visual picture of that collapse. You can see how many counties shifted to the right. So that's one story from the election. Second story from the election is it just proves Americans can't do math. Still. And Stu raises a great point. A number of pollsters, the polls were right. The polling margin, the election result was within the margin of error. So the polls on the whole, and especially at the national level, were correct. Where we all failed is we read them without the probability. We read them as certainties instead of recognizing when the RNC and Nate Silver, a number of pollsters that morning said Trump had a 30%, 40% chance
of
winning.
Well, Nate Silver is the one who said that Donald Trump and the Chicago Cubs both had the same chance.
But even just a 1 in 3 chance of something happening, we are not surprised when a Major League Baseball player has a hit. That's a 1 in 3 chance of happening. So why are we surprised that Trump won? Well, we're surprised because we didn't think that player would get that hit. We didn't think the Cubs would win this. So the surprise factor is in there as well. Last is, and this is where the pollsters got it just utterly wrong, and to me it's shades of 2008, 2009 all over again. It's the Great Recession story. Remember in the Great Recession, the problem was that things that the statisticians said moved separately all moved together. Mortgage bonds and stocks all moved in the same direction at the same time, which all the model says never happens. The polling model that fed, or the voting likely voter model that fed most election predictions said the Midwest does not move as a block. The states move independently. Well, I give you that big red picture to say that, oops, once again, we had a model failure. The people constructing the model made some assumptions that just got completely blown to smithereens in this election. That's the real story of the error that occurred. Yeah.
So I guess we've all decided then the game we're playing tonight is every time someone says pollster, it's drink. That's the plan for this evening. So I quickly want to open it to questions because us nerds will just continue talking and listen to ourselves continue to talk. But quick lightning round before we open it up. And this is something that Rick and I have been discussing at length, because again, hashtag nerd. Susan, is Michigan now a red state? That for so long we kind of, considered Michigan a blue state, and then it was purple because, of the Lansing hegemony of an executive branch, both houses, House and Senate. We went red. Is Michigan a red state now?
I think I'm going to lean on one of former Republican Party Chair Saul Anousis's favorite lines, that we're a blue state that can go red under the right circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
If in 2018 Debbie Stabenow gets knocked off, I will reevaluate. And Stu is probably working hard on that right now.
Yeah. So Stu...
But, like, at the state level, I mean, there's been total dominance for 6 years. That's really impressive.
Yeah. Stu, is Michigan a red state now?
I'd say it's a purple state. In governance, it's a red state, but I'd say it's a purple state. A lot of things went right for Republicans this election to make it that. You had a drop-off in the urban vote. You had an explosion in the rural vote. You had an explosion in the blue-collar vote. If you told me that Donald Trump would lose by 9 points in Oakland, win Kent County by 9,000 votes, and barely win Kalamazoo, but still win this state, I would tell you that's probably going to be really hard. And that's why I walked in seeing the Oakland numbers, thinking he's going to give it a good shot, but he'll probably lose by 3 points tonight.
Yeah.
The explosion was that blue-collar suburb, the rural vote that was just astronomical.
Jeff? Red state?
Are we a red state?
No, I don't think we're a red state. I think we're a confused state right now. I also think that since about 2000, there's really two Michigans. So two comments. One is, of all of the places in the United States talking about this kind of, this white middle class, white working class in general, that somehow feels lost or disaffected, we should really get that story because we've had almost 20 years of kind of, I'll call it an economic schizophrenia. In Michigan, if you're in the right industry, finance, insurance, real estate, services, 2008 to 2011 sucked. But before that and after that, things are good. But man, if you're in manufacturing, durable, light, incidental, there are sectors of the economy that we're in like year, almost 20 of things have not been going well.
Who so, Donald Trump spoke to.
Yeah, and he spoke to them. And again, we saw those kind of those Reagan Democrats that we thought were just in Oakland County. We found they live throughout the Midwest. And again, that's that picture that's there. So, red state, blue state, no, we're a confused state and we're kind of a drift state looking for the solution.
We're trying to find our way. Okay, let's open it up to some questions. Raise your hand. Steve will come find you. If you'll say just your first name so we know who you are.
It doesn't have to be your real first name.
My name is Jerry, and I'd like to get this off on the right note. Had Hillary Clinton won, as with Barack Obama and Bill Clinton, why should anyone who didn't vote for Donald Trump accept him as president? Because we all know, had Clinton won, we probably would not be being told to get over it, or any of this other stuff. And in fact, I remember the 60s when people on the left were told, America, love it or leave it, which meant my America, not yours.
Is that a question?
Well, yeah. That's a question for our Republican representative there.
Sure. And I can appreciate that. I was I did an Issues and Ale on November 1st, which was a week before the election, and I was asked, about some of the issues involving will they accept the results, and I said, of course they will. And if Hillary Clinton wins, Republicans will accept that result, and if Donald Trump wins, Democrats will accept that result, because we're in a durable republic, and we accept results of elections, and that's what's made our government different from almost every other government in the world. Yeah, I believe they accepted he was the president, and he's been there for 8 years.
Yeah, right. I don't think so.
Okay.
Let's get a temperature check of the folks in the room, though. I mean, how many of you are accepting the fact that Donald, are you happy, do you like it? How many of you are accepting the fact that once the Electoral College goes ahead and votes, as we assume they will on December 19th, that Donald Trump will become president? Are there people that actually are just not going to accept that? Okay, so like four people. Okay, let's go to the next question.
Name? Okay. I have a question about how... Oh, my name, George.
Hi, George.
Hi. I have a question about the libertarian vote.
Sure.
Where did it come from? Did it come from Republicans or did it come from Democrats?
Who voted for Gary Stein? Gary Johnson?
Freudian.
So, or Jill Johnson. Let's just make up names. Drink.
I'm going to hear kind of behind your question, you know, where did those votes come from and did it cost the election one way or the other in Michigan? All the numbers I've seen, and they're still doing kind of final counts across the state, but based on the complete but uncertified count, two stories jump out at me. One is there were no votes stolen from either side, or if they did, they were canceled out. So meaning that third-party vote, think back to the Clinton-Bush-Perot election. Perot basically got in the 20s. The third parties didn't even break into double digits in Michigan, so that wasn't a factor. Much more of a factor in Michigan was, again, as Stu said, part of the story is, again, urban voters didn't show up, rural voters showed up. That was a 300,000-vote swing to the Republican Party. So that's big problem number one. Problem number two is, how many people didn't vote for president? So forget, you know, Republican, Democrat, or the third parties, or even writing in, you know, Mickey Mouse, your local police chief, whatever. We had twice as many people this year not vote for president as 4 years ago. 80,000 people didn't write in anything for president. So between the turnout between the turnout of urban to rural, and then another, so 400,000 votes that could have been counted basically either went to the Republican side or weren't there, and turnout wasn't there. Our turnout was basically unchanged from Obama's election.
But
so
Jeff,
a whole lot of people showed up, and that is true, but a whole lot of other people looked at both candidates and said, meh, and stayed home.
So you don't think it's fair then when people who still have, like, Nader heartburn say, you know, 140,000 votes went to Gary Johnson, and there was only a difference of 13, and we're still counting and making it official. You don't buy that argument.
No, in terms, you know, does the math say it's possible? Yes, the math says it's possible. But if you think of the story of the election, it's not a likely reason.
Don't know about those voters are, would they have voted regardless? Would they have gone and cast a ballot for the R or the D? Or would they have just stayed home? Or would they have skipped that race, like what Jeff was just talking about?
Well, here's the great thing. When you have an election that is determined by 10,000 votes, everybody is probably correct. Because there probably is no silver bullet theory. Maybe it was Stein voters. Maybe it was Bernie voters. Maybe it was libertarians who came home. Maybe it was Clinton's bad ground game. You know, it's probably a combination.
Sure.
And pretty much you can pick who you want to blame, and that's what people are doing.
Okay, next question. Where did Steve's sitting down on the job.
He's, like, really enthusiastic there in the back.
Okay.
I can only run so fast.
This is so funny. I think we should just make, like, Steve go.
Dun, dun, dun. Hi, I'm Mike, and I'm a bicyclist.
Hi.
Hi, Mike. I want to ask about going to the very local or regional, the four-county vote on the transportation system.
Sure.
That got shot down.
The regional
was
transfer authority.
Was that just the McComb-Reagan Democrats flexing their muscles, or was intrinsically Southeast Michigan is not ready for public transportation?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. Jeff, do you want to?
Jeff, do you have an answer? I mean, I think Jeff? I was pretty much lost in Macomb.
Jeff, what answers do you have in your book?
So when 150,000 people don't vote in Wayne, Oakland, and Macomb counties that showed up 4 years ago, I think, first of all, again, you have a turnout problem. I think also in Michigan especially.
Thanks, Obama.
Well, you know, you have a turnout problem. And whether you blame Obama or Clinton or the phase of the moon, whatever, they didn't show. Second, I think, especially in Southeast Michigan, the politics of Detroit, I take from this, continue to be the politics of Detroit. It's still a very, very tough issue. I think the sentiment of the election was kind of, we don't trust government, and therefore a regional tax was too close to government. It probably went down. But I think, it's back to the turnout. It's just that they also didn't turn out the votes. And it was close. I think it went by not much.
It was. And, yeah. Stu, one of the things you and I talked about was the idea, and this was a week before the election, that the pro-RTA, there was not one single sort of solid message of voting yes. And what we know that going ahead, if you don't have about 60% of folks saying, I'm for it, that a ballot question like that, particularly one with that much money, is going to go down.
Sure. You know, and I think the RTA suffered from one of the same flaws that the Clinton campaign suffered from. They never showed how it would affect the pocketbook
of
the voter.
I thought you were going to say Anthony Weiner.
No. But, you know, another one was McComb was on steroids in terms of how it voted. You know, I worked on the public works race there, which was the most expensive countywide race in the history of this state. And I tracked that race. I tracked Kemp Macomb County nightly. And you could see nightly that there was an intense interest from voters there. But there was also, that was Trump country. He was winning by 15, 20 points every single night in the tracking. And those voters were not voting for the RTA. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Steve.
Hi, can you hear me? Okay, I'm Abby.
Hi.
I'm gonna give you guys a hypothetical. Would Bernie have beaten Trump?
In Michigan or nationwide?
Oh, let's start with Michigan.
Okay. Who wants to start?
I'll take the first one. You know, it's interesting because before, the week before the election, it was, all you heard was basically, well, any Republican would have beaten Clinton. If this were Rubio, if this were Kasich, any one of them. And the Republicans did such a terrible job nominating that they dropped this race, which should have been a layup. And then the week after it was, God, the Democrats missed the layup. They should have, if they had just Bernie Sanders, which is, you know, it's bizarre if you think about it. But I think the one thing Bernie Sanders did in Michigan is why he won the primary and why he probably had a chance of winning the Rust Belt in the Midwest states. He had an economic message that he talked, and he locked in to the despair voters were feeling. And I bet his favorables were higher than Trump's. You know, Trump and Clinton both were somewhere in the high 50s through low 60s, which Trump is now actually, for the first time, above water in fave-unfave. But, you know, I guess hindsight, it's 2020. But yeah, there are some people who think Bernie could have had a better chance, but he did speak an economic message, which is the first part of the battle.
Susan, you've had your ups and downs with the Bernie bros over the past few months.
You know, the fantasy electoral college game is something that we all love. You know, it's not just Bernie. People have brought up Joe Biden, even, you know, Martin O'Malley, Elizabeth Warren, on and on. That's what happens when you lose. You never know what a race is going to be like until you run it. There's a lot of oppo against Bernie. I think my good friend Stu would have really relished the idea of taking on somebody who actually called himself a socialist. But at the same time, a lot of Trump voters that I talked to brought up some very negative terms for women. And Bernie wouldn't have had that issue. Maybe he connected better. I really don't know. But I do know that if you liked Bernie before, you probably think he could have won this race. That's just kind of the way it goes.
And as Stu was saying, had...
And to that end, continuing your homework on the other side of the sheet of paper, here's Bernie's problem. If you look at that lower graph and look at basically that Midwest shift that went Republican, this is the electoral math that Bernie would have had to do. I think Bernie could have won the Midwest. He could have undone what Clinton had done. Okay, so now he gets the Midwest. Midwest doesn't get you to 270.
Right.
You can't win the presidency on the Midwest alone. So while Bernie, in our hypothetical, you know, fantasy football electoral college, Bernie would win the Midwest, you have to look at all those other states. Are you going to tell me that Bernie could have won Texas? I don't buy that. You're going to tell me that Bernie could win the two coasts? Maybe Northeast, but you know, he quickly gets to a map that wouldn't get him over the hump either, knowing what we know now. So looking at this map. So hypothetically, yeah, it's great fun, but I don't think he would have gotten farther per se, given how the Republican turnout was.
But it certainly would have been an interesting race because we would have had two competing populist messages that we really didn't have in this. Matter of fact, one of the interesting dynamics of this race is up close till the very end is that both campaigns kept focusing on the other person. That really seemed like their goal was the last thing they wanted the voters to be thinking about was what the country would be like if the other person was elected president. The bet was on a vote based on fears rather than aspirations.
Well, and what we saw was over those months that every time the one candidate was out of the spotlight, they did better.
Yeah.
That it was whoever everyone was paying attention to was doing worse. Okay. Yeah. Let's just take all this group of questions out.
Okay.
Thank you. I'm Frank, and I'm just wondering, Frank, how can we protect our democracy if the parties don't follow the laws or the rules? I'm specifically talking about the Supreme Court. Obama did 51% twice. Trump is going to get 47%, and he's supposed to pick my justice? I think you guys stole my vote.
Mm-hmm. But this is our system, right? We're not a parliamentary democracy. We're not, you know, where other folks vote. If you get the majority of votes, whether it's over 50% or not.
Yeah, so two points on that. One is the Electoral College and the popular vote are kind of like first downs in a football game, right? First downs are highly correlated with the score of a football game, but it is possible to lose a football game even though you had more first downs than someone else. So the way you score points in football is touchdowns, extra points. The way you get to be president is the Electoral College. Trump won. Period. On the second part, I think it's interesting. Again, Stu talked earlier about what we thought before the election and what we thought after the election. I want you all to roll your minds back a month ago. Okay. And I think collectively we're all going, well, we're going to have a new president, and oh boy, I hope they do something with Congress, especially if you're on the liberal side. You're like, you know, I hope they fix Congress. Now what we know now, if you're on the liberal side, you're suddenly saying, thank God for Congress. I mean, just think about this. The greatest assist, as you were talking about, you know, how do we protect democracy? Holy crap, Congress might have a role. You know, I trust Congress to slow roll anybody who is president, especially this Congress. And I think this Congress...
So you're saying Democrats should be, you know, thanking the Lord for the Ryan firewall?
In Michigan, we've seen this before. I think President Trump is going to have a really, really aggressive first year, just like Governor Snyder did in his first year, where he ran the table and all the legislators were looking around saying, he can't do that quickly. I suspect that Trump is going to do the same thing. But remember what happened with Governor Snyder. 16, 18, 20 months in, suddenly the legislature remembered, wait a second, we can say no. So I honestly, and I say this with, you know, two political science degrees, and I can't believe I'm saying this in some respects, thank God for Congress. I think we just got to survive 12 months, and then we'll start to see things get more to a normal legislative cycle. Now, to the Supreme Court, you're right. Congress has an advice and consent. The Senate role in that, that's a different story. The answer there is to the victors belong the spoils. We're gonna see who Mr. Trump picks for the Supreme Court and how many openings he has.
And don't forget that the Democrats in service of their president basically killed the filibuster. So they gave away their opportunity to stop.
They didn't do the nuclear.
They didn't for the Supreme Court, and that's the big discussion. So, you know, again, here's where, you know, to prove my case, the filibuster still holds for Supreme Court nominees. So any one senator can block and hold President Trump's Supreme Court nominee. So the filibuster still stays. Now, whether the Republicans will choose the nuclear option, you know, that's what we'll see, and that's what will be discussed in Congress. Again, thank you, Congress. Question mark?
Stu, we're talking a lot about Republican politics here.
Sure. Well,
is the question, though, that if we don't get over 50%, then we don't do anything?
No.
Okay,
the
sure.
I have a legitimate president that should have nominated, I'm thinking,
that should have nom- he nominated the justice, and they should have gone through the legitimate process. And just by them saying that, oh gosh, we'll just put it away and forget about it. And now they have a chance to how many justices will they be able to put in the next 2 years?
Well, we're looking at, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg suddenly drinking a lot of emergency tablets. I don't know if you saw Saturday Night Live. That was pretty great. I mean, yes, but here's the thing. Everyone in this room right now, you're cheering and you're saying amen to that. And whether you agree with it or not, you here in this room are the 0.00001% of folks who are out on a Monday night talking about our democracy and what's wrong with it and how to fix it. But as Jeff said, less than 50% of people came out to vote. And of that, 25% voted for one candidate, about 25% voted for the other. That is 1/4 of people who voted for a president. Does that seem unfair? Yes, but that's the system. And until people start feeling like it affects them and care about the issue that you're making, nothing's going to change. We in here are cheering and saying, amen, it's not fair, but it's the system. And we play by the rules. And that's what Republicans did.
And the reality is this, is that sometimes the checks and balances work for you. Sometimes the checks and balances will work against you.
On that panel that I was part of on November 1st, when I was driving down, I heard the news story, and I was asked about this. There was a Senate candidate who apparently that night said in a closed-door room, we're not going to block this for 4 years. And I get asked, is that possible? And I said, no, it's not possible. At some point, whoever wins the election, they're going to have to confirm Supreme Court candidates. That's just the way our systems work. Since 1932, there has been no confirmation of a Supreme Court justice in the presidential election year. It just wasn't. In 1988, it was Senator Joe Biden who led the filibuster against President Bush at the time. President Reagan. But it's just the way the system works. And yes, now Donald Trump is likely to have a series of Supreme Court nominees because of the timing.
I think that's a longer way of saying that it's a lot easier to throw up a wall for 4 months than it is for 4 years.
Absolutely. And for folks who believe that is unfair, it is deeply unfair. But again, a majority of people didn't turn out or care enough about this issue that you're bringing up. I mean, plain and simple. Well, and that is a fair question. And Stu, this is something that we brought up in Detroit too, folks saying that Republicans in Michigan or in other states were actively suppressing minority votes or votes in general that might have gone to Democrats.
It was brought up. I mean, one person actually made the argument that because insurance is so hard to get in Detroit, that people in Detroit can't vote, so they have to go back to their home residence. And so shouldn't we allow for insurance fraud into the voting system, which I thought was a little bit of a bizarre argument to make, but that was the argument that was made.
Jeff, if we allowed absentee voting in Michigan any reason.
Yeah, and this is where we have, their suppression, certainly in other states, had very strict voter ID laws. And I think that is...
So just a second. Yeah. Let's get back to...
I agree. Was there suppression in Michigan? I think at the margins. I think there was more suppression in other states that had very, very strict voter ID laws. So let's just say that for there. I think in Michigan, the primary concern was apathy or not voting. Now, that being said, it's interesting to me as a Michigan resident who's running all around on election day like all of you are, at work, at school, wherever. In Florida, I think somewhere north of 50 or 60%, 50-60% of the vote comes in before election day, meaning most of the vote is already sitting in locked ballot boxes. Here in Michigan, we're one of the kind of the few states that we do have absentee, but it's not no reason. You have to give a petition, certify. That to me is an interesting conversation. Is there's a convenience argument that can be made in Michigan of why don't we loosen up absentee a little bit? That the history in Michigan is the argument has been, but as soon as we allow absentee voting, that's when fraud happens. That's been disproven. But I think there is a need for a conversation in Michigan about how we vote. Do we need to go the extreme of voting for the 2 weeks prior like Florida? I'm not saying that, but can we in the 21st century maybe not all have to physically show up somewhere and go to over a couple of days? That also helps some of the suppression argument. When you try to suppress in one day, it's easier than if you're trying to suppress across a week. It's just harder. So if we're concerned about suppression, I say the greatest way to fix it is let's open up the absentee voter. Let's make it a little less restrictive in the state.
Although, interestingly, there was a study done of that, and seniors like absentee and early voting, but millennials who get out and vote apparently like going to the polls on election day.
Well, there is something, I remember my first time in the ballot box, you went with your parents, you saw, you had the nice,
we closed the curtain,
real curtains, like real fabric and real metal, and ka-chunk as it closed. And now what do? I take a Sharpie and I connect the dots. Optical character voting just isn't, it's not as fun.
And you're not even allowed to take a selfie while you're doing it.
Yeah, and these kind of, generally silly, I understand it, but, we have to kind of loosen up as the state, and I do not tolerate fraud, but there's a long way between everybody vote in person and rampant, you know, voting of the dead. You know, there is some middle ground that we can address in the state, and I think we should. I think, again, in terms of the Republicans run everything in Michigan, as a general statement, that, you know, they broke it, they bought it. Meaning, at what point do the Republicans' own constituents say, convenience, folks, you know, let's loosen this up a little bit. And we'll play that out. We'll see.
Well, and Michigan's Republican Secretary of State had hinted on some willingness behind that.
And the Republican chair of the House Elections Committee.
Yeah. And then got tamped down pretty quickly.
Well, I could say this. No one can blame the Clinton campaign can't complain about the early vote is causing them the race, because they were supposed to have this dominance over early voting in Florida, in Arizona, in Ohio. And what the statistics bore out was that did not happen.
That's not true.
If you looked at the absentee voting in Michigan, they knew there was a problem.
Right.
But when Bill Clinton came in on the Wednesday before the election, because they saw they were not getting the vote in areas they needed to get.
They were far ahead in Florida, at least. Where they got killed in Florida was the voting on election day in the I-4 corridor. If everything went according to plan, they would have been fine. I do think that there is a legitimate issue with vote suppression. If you look at Ohio, Wisconsin, and North Carolina, especially if you look at North Carolina, where the Supreme Court there found that Republicans went block by block in African-American neighborhoods to make it more difficult to vote. Now, that, to my knowledge, has never happened here, but it is significant. Those are all swing states, and I don't care what party you're from. I don't think that's the way voting should work. I also don't think that this discussion about absentee voting should have anything to do with this election. I don't care who it benefits. I go back to my days when I lived in Iowa. My first time I voted, I was a student at the University of Iowa, and there were voting booths that were set up in the student union. That would make people lose their heads in Michigan. Can you imagine voting booths set up at the University of Michigan student union? No way. Iowa's a fairly reasonable, moderate state. They don't care. They're just about good governance. They've had a Republican governor for a long time. The other time that I really, really needed it was back in 2002 when I had just given birth and I had a colicky baby. And the idea of walking two blocks to vote in the snow seemed like I may as well go to Siberia. So when somebody came to my door with a ballot and said, hey, would you like to vote absentee? I almost hugged her. You don't hear about shenanigans in Iowa. You don't hear about vote fraud because they've had it, it's worked, and I don't think there's any reason why we shouldn't have that universally.
People in Iowa are focused on the butter cow.
Okay, name please.
My name is Brad. I'm talking about absentee voting. We've been talking a little bit about sports analogies recently. And I kind of equate voting 3 to 4 weeks before the election, similar as a football game, saying it's over in the third quarter. So my only question is, do we think there's a problem voting 3 or 4 weeks before an election where all the facts or all the information's not out yet?
And I think that, and Stu brought this up earlier with the late breaking news from the FBI. I think as a general statement, now, you know, everyone's kind of made up their mind. In this particular election, when you have that news 10 days ahead, you know, I don't know what the rules are.
Oh, but it didn't really seem to affect people's decisions as much as whether or not they got out to vote at all.
Well, but I think it did, and I've seen some exit polling that, the 13, 16, you know, in some states bordering close to 20%. Undecideds in some states were running twice as high as historical average.
Well, and
so it just kind of reasonably, a rational, prudent person would say, if your undecideds are twice as high as normal and you get a surprise in the last 10 days that drags down one candidate, that may be what made you stay. You know, and this is the unknowable. We will never know. It's gone and in the past. But we had a number of things happen in this election that we've never seen before.
Let's also not forget, though, that in Michigan, actually, if you vote absentee, you get one do-over. You can go back and say, I want a ballot again, and you can do that. So you vote 3 weeks in advance, and suddenly 2 days beforehand, something comes out that says I made an awful decision. You go back, you scrub it, and you get to vote again.
No one does it, but yes, you can.
It's an option. Yeah.
Yeah, even in Oregon.
Your name, please,
Brent,
sir.
Monsieur Hoffman.
Brent. Even in Oregon, you can vote the day of, I believe. In Canada, you can vote the day of. Even in Iraq, under George Bush, you can stick your thumb in die and vote. But yet, we have an America that is into voter suppression. We work overtime at keeping people from voting in this country. And that is wrong.
Okay.
Hi, you know what's great about America? Are the people up here who are so devoted to their all-American pizza that, like, they're figuring out how they're going to sit in the seats and still eat.
Looks
like,
so good.
Bravo. Bravo.
Yeah. My name's Rachel, and I was just wondering if you could speak to how the Michigan legislature, in my opinion, sort of pulled a quick one and separated the relationship between the two bills for no reason absentee voting and the
straight party
straight
voting.
Ticket vote, yes.
Sure, and Susan, you're making some noise. You want to take that one?
My cynical answer is that the no reason absentee voting was a fig leaf that was quickly removed when it was no longer useful. I would assume that Republicans make the argument that it was a deeply flawed bill that needs more consideration.
Stu?
Well, you know, one of the things I think is interesting is the straight party ballot. There's a lot of sort of the consensus afterwards.
We'll get back to that. But what about this idea that they were tie barred together and then suddenly not?
Suddenly they were separated?
You know, yeah.
That just kind of legislative process. You know, they couldn't get the support for it. But I don't really have much more to say than that. But the straight party ballot was interesting because it was seen as injurious to Republicans by a lot of Republicans. And what it wound up, and again, I don't really have the proof of the anecdote that it did provide some of these statewide wins, but a lot of people think that it actually caused statewide Republicans to win in the end. And there were 5 of 8 of the education board races they wound up winning.
You texted Mark Brewer that night and said, thank you.
Yeah, I still don't know conclusively if it makes sense or not. But
I take a look at Macomb County government, mm-hmm. and you have two complete unknowns who beat the clerk and treasurer. It's hard to make the argument that that doesn't happen without straight ticket voting. I mean, literally nobody knew who these people were.
But the idea was Democrats wanted to keep a straight party ticket.
A lot of people spent a lot of money on both sides
of
this.
See, that's the problem.
Some of it was your money.
That's the problem. Whenever any party tries to game the system for their own advantage, there are unintended consequences. I know Stu's been on the other side of this. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. Maybe it helps in 2018. Maybe it permanently screws Democrats for a decade. That's the fun of elections.
I will say there's a lot of strategists who are too clever by half. They always try to kind of outwit the system, and eventually the system outwits them.
And again, pointy-headed researcher, I have a number, of course, on this. So somebody, not me, but somebody did a 20-county analysis of ticket splitting. And again, the narrative, you all rewind in your minds, a month ago, the narrative was a number of people were going to vote for Hillary Clinton because they couldn't stand Donald Trump and then kind of come home to the Republican Party. So that the fear of kind of the original bill passers to the question about these two bills in the Michigan legislature is they were very worried, so they wanted to split this up. What actually happened is Hillary Clinton lost 163,000 votes compared to Obama 4 years prior due to ticket splitting in the 20 largest counties of the state. So this to me is another, just as Stu said, you know, these people who think they're smart try to game the system because they're so smart. There was ticket splitting. It was just in exactly the opposite way. 163,000 people voted for Donald Trump and then went home to the Democratic Party. And wrap your heads around that one as well. There's just some factoids in this where I
heard someone describe it really well on one of the Sunday morning news shows, which is that we are, you know, right now a three-party country. that we have the Republicans, the Democrats, and the Trump Party.
Well, again, to my
wrap your mind around
my
that.
My parents and I spent really good money on 2 degrees in political science that have been rendered utterly useless this entire election. So we don't know, okay? Just let's all admit, we don't know which President Trump or Trumps we are going to get. We don't know if we'll get the one who's kind of magnanimous, the one who's kind of crazy, the one who kind of alternates between magnanimous and crazy.
But there's a difference between the President Trump that's going to show up.
We don't know, and this is the big question to me come January 20th, is in the next year, what wins? What ism wins? Does Trumpism win? Or does Ryanism win? Meaning what wins? Is it Donald Trump's view of the world and policies and procedures, or is it the more moderate view of Speaker Ryan and others in the Republican
Party? Which has zero to do with why people voted for Donald Trump.
But we'll see how that
happens. Did you hear the crowd, though, when you said the more moderate Paul Ryan? We all, there was a breath of,
you bring up this sort of
the
third
Trump
rail.
Firewall or the Ryan firewall.
One of the things you bring up is one of the soothsayers in this election, someone who saw this coming from a mile away, was Michael Moore. Michael Moore came out and he had a pulse on this.
Did it hurt for you to say that still?
No, he had a pulse. When I saw his video, I said, this guy is getting what's going on. I'll tell you, I went through this on November 1st. When I went to the August 2015 first presidential debate in Cleveland between Republicans, when I saw all of them sitting on stage, and at the time I was about to work for Jeb Bush, I said, Trump's going to win this. I just saw it the way they were all interacting. I went back to the hotel. The RNC consultants who were there laughed at me and said, you're crazy. And I went back to my office and told them, I think Trump's going to be our nominee. And people thought I was nuts. And then in December of 2015, when he was in Grand Rapids the week before Christmas and 10,000 people lined up to see him in the freezing rain, I thought, this guy has something nobody saw. But Michael Moore saw it, and what Michael Moore said is, this guy is a human Molotov cocktail. He's the biggest FU in the history of American electoral system, and you guys are dumb for not picking up that he's going to win. He saw it coming, and there were other people who saw it too.
And I can vouch for Stu because his office is in the same building as my office, and we have talked about this in the hallway, and Stu did call it early on.
Michael Moore also said that Romney was going to win. I mean, sometimes you keep telling the same story, eventually you might be correct.
Michael Moore is a good family friend, and that is what I was biting my tongue to say, Susan.
Have you been up to his mansion at Torch Lake? I've heard it's lovely.
Okay, let's keep moving on to more questions.
Hello, my name is Christine, and I would like to ask Mr. Sandler, what is wrong with America that Trump is going to make great again?
Well, I think, one of the things that's been talked about is Trump actually, he's got a big ultimatum when it comes to some of these blue-collar voters. He has some issues in terms of the economy. He talked about breaking the Trans-Pacific Partnership. He was one of the first candidates. I think he was the first candidate on the presidential level to talk about that. So he's got an economy to prove. He's got small business jobs to create, and he's got to improve the economy for middle America. He also has a foreign policy, which there are a lot of people who would say that right now the U.S. has to really improve its standing in the world, and that's a big challenge for him.
She said look at his appointments.
Okay. In terms of the foreign policy, he hasn't done a Secretary of State or he hasn't done a Defense Secretary. In terms of Chief of Staff, Reince Priebus, who I know very well, is extremely competent. In terms of, let's see, who else?
What are your thoughts on Steve Bannon?
I will tell you this is interesting. I've actually talked on the phone 2 or 3 times to Steve Bannon. I've never seen the side of him that other people say. I recognize what people think of some of the articles and things. But I've never seen that side. He's been personable. He's been intelligent. And I think, people will bear out what he turns out to be.
Hi, my name is Judy, and I want to go back to voter suppression for a minute. I teach at Michigan State University, and one of the things my students said to me, and they come from many states, they were upset that they couldn't vote because in Michigan, if you register to vote by mail, this is one line in the regulations, if you register to vote by mail, you must vote in person the first time. Many of them missed that and got and did not have the chance to vote because they live in the UP, and we did not have the day off. There were similar students from Texas and other states. I'm sorry, but millennials want to vote. 100% of my students wanted to vote, and they were very upset that they couldn't.
And don't forget the Rogers Law.
Right.
That's where you were going to go?
Yeah, yep. Go right
Oh,
ahead.
No, no, no.
You covered it.
I did. The Mike Rogers Law in what year was it when Diane Byrum faced Mike Rogers?
2000.
And he was. And as a state senator, he sponsored a bill that required that the address on your voter registration card match the address on your driver's license. And he won a very slim election victory, in part on margins that may or may not have been decided at Michigan State.
Okay, let's keep moving on. Steve.
Hey, my name is Sean, and I really want to kind of maybe change the conversation here, but with the WikiLeaks and the Democratic National Convention and then Trump emerging from an extraordinarily crowded Republican field, do you see the primary process for either party changing after this election? It seems like both parties were pretty unhappy with the results at the top of the ticket, at least.
Stu?
I think that's a Stu.
Well, you know, it's interesting because, like I said, most strategists who try to outwit the system mostly get outwit by the system. You know, I did a panel with Congresswoman Brenda Lawrence at the time where it looked like, you know, Hillary Clinton was having a little bit of trouble, and she kind of said to me on this panel, don't you wish you had a superdelegate system like us? And I said, no, we have our system, and if you can't win it, you're probably candidate's not good enough. I thought our system was extremely fair. I was proud of Reince Priebus for holding the Republicans to that system. My candidate didn't win the primary. I don't know really what you can do to change it. I think Trump was a better candidate in the primaries and proved out to be a better candidate in the general. And I think anyone who tries to take a lesson from this primary and tries to game their system the next time is going to get beat by it.
I think you're correct.
And Susan's nodding her head, and Jeff is nodding his head.
It's interesting, you know, again, the modern way we elect presidents, or, you know, winnow down the field in the presidential candidate, I can't remember, 1972 or 1976 is kind of when the modern primary system came to be. And it was because both parties out of the 1960s, Goldwater for the Republicans, Chicago for the Democrats, said we've got to get rid of the smoke-filled room. So in some sense, you know, we all kind of asked for it. We all said we want to directly, we can't directly elect the president. We can at least directly elect the nominee, and that stuck. We work for a nonpartisan firm, so we observe this. We're not kind of in the trenches. We're one off. It's interesting to me that both parties kind of tweaked their rules, they thought, to each party's benefit during this cycle, and both got bit in the butt by it. I mean, Democrats tweaked it to try to coronate Hillary Clinton and get people to coalesce as quickly as possible. Whoops, Bernie made it pretty far. You know, that undid what they were trying to game. The Republicans were concerned out of the last time that there were too many people on the stage. We need to get faster down to a smaller number of Republican candidates. So that's why the superdelegates weren't there. It was straight up winner take all. We're going to winnow it as quickly as possible. Whoops. You know, it took until March or April to get down to the two or three. So each of the parties put their finger on the lever after 2012 to try to change it in a way they thought was better. And both parties, I think, may be kind of saying, we may not like half of what we did that we thought was good.
Which, again, is what we've been talking about with the nuclear option in the Senate. Again, what we've been talking about straight party ticket voting, the idea that if you can kind of change the system to your benefit,
And that, I think, back to the gentleman's question here earlier, I apologize, I misunderstood it, but your question about Judge Merrick, you know, the appointee, Judge Merrick, who's going to kind of winnow on the vine here, and then Trump gets to appoint a nominee. There is a change in the tone and tenor of politics where Stu is right, and it's generally known that it's really, really tough / bordering on impossible to get a Supreme Court nominee through in the last year, barring, you know, unforeseen circumstances. But we have right now in federal politics this kind of, to call it third grade mentality is too generous. It's, you know, lower elementary, tit for tat, you did that, so I'm going to do that. That kind of longer sense of history or the longer sense of, you know, I'm going to screw you today, but I got to work with you tomorrow, and on the whole, it's going to come out fine. It's more people on both parties just kind of stop at the screw you. and they don't move past it. So I think Republicans are going to own for a while what they did to the Supreme Court.
There's a natural tendency to say that's what the rule. Yeah, you know, that's
they're
going to
own it
are.
Now. They are going to get a Supreme Court nominee. They're going to replace him. Judge Merrick will not get.
And Republicans
appointed.
Will go all the way back to Robert Bork.
But that story will continue of what they did. So they own it. And again, on the Republican side, they can go back to Bork and say, you know, this wasn't the first time we had a really, you know, a not proud moment as a country. But again, that was my point. But they won, and we're all going to suffer the consequences of that, and we can hope, again, thank God for Congress, that we'll see how it plays out.
And yet you're saying we've hit this third-grade mentality, but isn't what we've been saying all along is that Donald Trump is an indication of the frustration with that system?
And this is the interesting thing, too, as an observer. You know, I remember when the entire cost of a state house race was, you know, $30,000, $50,000, you know, all in. And now $50,000 probably doesn't get you out of the primary in a general state house. We're seeing state house races at six figures. We're seeing Senate races getting awfully close to seven. So collectively, because of how quick media is moving, information moving, we are moving as a people, we're kind of getting the system that we kind of allowed to happen. And, you know, until we stand up and say we're sick of it and change it. Now, half of the country did stand up and say we're sick of it, change it. They made an interesting choice, but there's another half of the country out there that has a different opinion of things to change. That is that's going to be the back and forth tug of war that we're going to have for this generation, 15, 20 years. In that sense, for me, we're kind of back to the 60s. We're going to go through this period of 10 or 20 years of unsettlement before we settle, and then we'll have a 40 or 50 year, you know, general swing. We've seen this before in American.
Oh my God!
Politics.
Everyone, take a drink after that analysis. Yeah.
Hi, John here.
Hi.
I have a quick question. You know, in 2000, the fact that Gore won the popular vote by about 500,000 over Bush seemed to be like a defining characteristic of that election. Like, it was mentioned in every article. There were articles like front page stories. Is this the end of the Electoral College? Hillary Clinton is over 1 million votes over Trump and probably will end up...
More than 1.5 million, about 1.7 right now.
Right, it might be as high as 2 million votes over Trump. Now, I understand you play by the rules, and that's completely fine. I think Trump's point that, well, if the point was to win the popular vote, we would have held rallies in California and New York, and we probably would have won that too. But since he didn't, is there a point that the country will no longer be willing to accept a popular vote victory, a margin... I mean, if 2 million isn't enough to seem to bother people this time, what is the margin that would bother people enough to make change?
Well, first of all, we've already seen legislation introduced about ending the Electoral College for that, which I think we can all agree isn't going to go anywhere.
No. What was introduced is, and I believe I have this number very accurate, is the 233rd attempt, I kid you not, of Congress to repeal the Electoral College. So
the thing is, the political establishment is used to working with the Electoral College, and so they're going to continue to work with the Electoral College.
Well, and we would make the argument, too.
Life's a lot easier when you know that California's going to go here, and New York's going to go here, and Texas's going to go here, and Utah's going to go there, and then we can just focus on the battleground states.
Yeah. Susan, you were going to jump in?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's going to be a change to the Electoral College. I mean, we did see some attempts to change it with some states, including Michigan, to apportion electors, which ironically would have really hurt Donald Trump this time because it would be in the wrong states, which is another one of those unintended consequences. But 2 million votes is a lot, and certainly it feeds the anger of Democrats, just as it would in the reverse. And it seems like it should be a corollary to all of the Democratic Death Watch stories, and there are about 1 million of them right now, because while it's serious for the Democrats that they lost Michigan, they lost Ohio, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, etc., Hillary Clinton still won 2 million more votes, so that's not an indication of a party that is completely dead.
And there is actually a movement called the National Popular Vote, and there are a few iterations of it. It's championed by a former Michigan Republican Party chair, Saul Anuzis, and it's basically the iteration that he prefers would be a compact among the states that you cast your electoral votes for whoever gets the most popular votes, and that means that all of a sudden every state and every voter is in play.
The only thing I'll add is, you know, it's interesting perspective, because I remember there was a panel on Morning Joe the Monday before the election where Steve Schmidt was predicting that Clinton was going to win over 330 electoral votes, and then the panel talked about for about 20 minutes, what if Trump wins the popular vote and loses the electoral college? And they went on and on. You know, I was one of the books I've been flipping through for some perspective is Stan Greenberg's Middle Class Dreams, written in 1996. Greenberg was Bill Clinton's pollster. He did a series of focus groups from about 90 to 96 about Macomb County voters and showed how it flip-flopped during the Reagan years. And one of the interesting things was Bill Clinton in 92 came to Macomb County three times to a point he turned to his observers and said, does Macomb County have more electoral votes than Florida? Because he didn't realize how many times he was coming there. You know, and I just say from a Michigan perspective, we should be thankful there is an electoral college because we would never see a presidential candidate if there wasn't.
Well, and let's remember the stories that we were reading from the Times and some other fact-based organizations, hint, hint, wink, wink, that said that Clinton actually in the final days of Hillary's campaign was trying to get the campaign to go back into kind of Rust Belt states and find those workers.
His Bubba voters.
Uh-huh, the Bubba voters. And he was kind of brushed off and said, no, Bill, you know, that was the 90s, the early 90s. Those voters, we've got them in the tank. You don't need to worry about it. And kind of dusted him off.
Whoops.
Well, I mean, Stu knows this better than anyone. After a campaign, when you lose, there's a lot of CYA. Yeah, I'm not saying that didn't take place, but there may have been other conversations where people, you know, that has not become public.
Well, one interesting thing I want to know, if I could ask the Clinton campaign anything, is why did you send Barack Obama to Ann Arbor and not Detroit on the Monday before? What was the thinking behind that? And I don't know the answer.
Because there was something going on in Detroit, a police officer's funeral.
Detroit's a massive city. I don't buy that. Something else was going on.
I buy it. It just fits what I know about
presidential
business.
Well, and this is the narrative, that they couldn't go to Detroit because there was a fallen officer and his funeral was that day. That's one of the narratives. The other is that, no, of course, Detroit is a big city and that they could have figured other routes to go.
A presidential visit just freezes a region.
Well, I'm saying that there are two different analyses of that, and it's a question we may never...
The one thing I would say is they knew Detroit was a problem the Wednesday before. When Bill Clinton came in...
He didn't have to go...
They knew it, and they were all saying, this is insurance. This is just insurance. This isn't insurance. When she shows up Wednesday and Hillary Clinton shows up Friday, there is something going on that's not going right, and it's just intriguing that they couldn't figure out how to solve
it. Was it a mysterious phone call that Ronna Romney McDaniel got that said that Trump was up 8,000 votes in Michigan?
Well, I think it was not only the RNC that actually saw the modeling. It was the Trump tracking. It had to be the Clinton tracking. There had to be enough people who saw this is a real problem. And if it's a problem in Michigan, then it's a problem in Pennsylvania, it's a problem in Wisconsin, and it was a problem that kind of swept through the mid.
But they didn't see the tracking in Wisconsin. I mean, there was stuff that was not being picked up. And so I think it's rather clear that they picked up what was going on in Michigan. One thing that I personally missed on the Republican side, you know, when you see very nervous, cautious congressmen like Bill Huizenga and Tim Walberg, who looked like he was facing a tough re-election fight, start giving Trump a warm hug, that should have been an indication of where the numbers were moving.
Hi, guys. My name is Kate, and I'm an environmental and sustainability student at Michigan State.
Hi, Kate.
And I'm... Thanks, guys.
Ooh, the environment.
I'm wondering, especially with one of our candidates and now president-elect being a climate denialist, why wasn't climate change more of an issue at these debates? And if it had been, do you think it would have made a difference? Because I'm afraid of what we're facing now and his cabinet.
I don't think it would have made a big difference just because I think that people are locked into their views on that.
I have no idea if it would have moved numbers. I do think it's startling that was never a question in any of the four debates.
Not once.
Education wasn't a question. There are a lot of missed issues.
And I think, too, you know, the opening comment I made is Americans are bad at math. You know, that's something the election showed. I think there's something else, you know, humans are bad at, and that's thinking of big, scary problems over many, many years. So climate change, you know, it's kind of, to me, it's two problems wrapped in one. One is, do you believe the cause? And then I believe in climate change. I'm saying other people say that that's the first question. Then the next is, what do you do about it? Because when you start talking about something that, you know, you can say you haven't seen yet, and other people say, have you seen the polar bear walking by your front door? You know, there are things that we're seeing now, but there are two different issues at play. Unfortunately, you know, I love public policy. It's what I'm passionate about, and I'm disappointed that on both sides of the aisle, through how many debates just on the Republican side, Democrats as well, there were a number of issues that we didn't talk about or get the weight, and if they did, they were kind of quickly glossed over. It's like, we can fix education if you just do X, Y, and Z. Well, that's not true. You know, it's a massive, massive system in the state. Climate change. You can go down a number of issues that were not covered in depth in the election that are very, very complex and that will matter. And that's just where we're at.
But wasn't a lot of that this was an election cycle where we really were largely locked in at the top of the ticket, and the debate was over issues of character and what kinds of people these were, as opposed to what they actually thought about?
I think character, but again, I think we're also confused. You know, think back to the 1980s when we thought, you know, the Japanese were going to eat our lunch, and it was Japan everything, and we were law, and then Ronald Reagan comes out of that. I think this was an election about change, and of the 23 people running for president, two got the kind of the change mentality right. They had their finger on the pulse. Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. They saw it coming. So shame on the other 21 that they couldn't read the room.
Well, you know, Rick, you brought up the fact that this election a lot of the time wasn't about the person presenting their vision. This was about the one person presenting, this country will be a disaster if that person is the president. You know, Haley Barbour, I was at a panel, and the former Mississippi governor and RNC chair put it really succinctly. He said,
if this election's about Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump wins. If this election's about Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton wins.
And it just, it, and I.
That's
I,
the best Haley Barbour impression.
but I think it did. And, you know, one of the key elements I think the Clinton campaign got wrong, one of the commercials I just kept watching and marveling at, there was a commercial they played over and over again where Trump went, and you can go F yourself, and we're going to blow the S out of them. And I watched it, and I said, I can't even tell you how many votes you're probably getting Trump by playing that over and over and over again, because that's exactly what a lot of these voters want to hear.
You know, that's almost a corollary, and Zoe knows this, just about my favorite political axiom is 75% of what you do in a campaign is irrelevant. You just don't know which 75% until after the campaign is over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so here's what's up. We've got a few more minutes. Okay, a few more questions. Selma Tucker, I'll give your name for you.
Question about Republicans governing. Obamacare, 20 million people off the rolls. What do you do about that? Can you actually get the economy to grow at 7%? And how do you pay for infrastructure without exploding the deficit?
But number four, you forgot to drop the mic. No. But Stu, I mean, those are four questions that I think we could jump in, we could spend hours at. But talk to me about the idea of rhetoric. And I think this was to the question earlier about what is Donald Trump going to do to, quote, make America great again? That was a very quick soundbite about feeding into folks' concerns and probably, I think, let's all be honest, some real scared and feelings about what their future looks like. Now he's looking at being president and has all of these ideas and things that he said he's going to do.
Let's focus on one of those, though, Zoe, which is the infrastructure one, because that's one
infrastructure
where...
Infrastructure wasn't part of it.
He said infrastructure.
Those are two of them.
Okay.
Obamacare and infrastructure.
And infrastructure is a place where President Trump might just run into some problems with his Republican Congress.
This is going to be an interesting one. It's going to be interesting to see where Trump's former relationships prior to him running take him. because one of the first things he's talked about is running an infrastructure bill. And we all know the price tag on that is probably going to be a pretty high one. So it's going to be interesting to see how he approaches a Republican Congress versus the Democratic minorities in Congress and see what he can pass. But he seems to be dead serious about it. And, again, that's a challenge.
Almost
no one's
Rick Snyder-like in that respect.
Only he can run huge deficits, and Rick Snyder can't.
That's true.
But, I mean, this goes back to Selma's question really seriously about how much time do we have and what needs to happen within that time that we need to see some changes and we need to see things getting better. I mean, how much time does he have?
Who knows? But, again, there are some voters, and that was the one thing about reading the Greenberg book, is that it showed voters vacillate between party to party. They got let down by Democrats. They went to Republicans, got let down Republicans. They went back to Democrats. So I think some of these voters that voted for Trump want immediate results, and I think he's imperative. One of the interesting things is this is a guy who came to power who really doesn't rely on party structures. So it's going to be interesting to see how he governs.
So Chuck Schumer and Donald Trump go out to dinner and just figure out an infrastructure bill, and that's that.
He's probably got a closer relationship with Chuck Schumer than he does with Paul Ryan.
Okay.
My name is Jill, and back to the question just before Selma's. There wasn't much discussion of issues that are important to us day to day, so how do we as the electorate try and elevate the conversation so that we really know what we're getting when we vote for A or B?
It starts by showing up. It's the basic politics 101, basic stuff. The comment was made earlier, 2 million people more voted for one candidate than the other. Okay, that's out of 80 million votes cast or so, I think is the national total, out of a nation of 330 million. So, just think of that funnel going down. Never underestimate the survival skill or the ability to read a room of a politician. So when politicians see that tone and tenor changing from us, they will change. But until then, they're going to keep doing what works. And what worked this time was appealing, again, to that Midwest kind of forgotten voter. That was the message that carried. And I agree with some comments earlier. That is not the death knell of the Democratic Party. They got 51-52% of the total votes cast. It's not the death knell. It's going to hurt. It's not a flesh wound, but it's going to hurt. But this was 2016. And then we have 2018, which is a massive election year in Michigan. All four of the top tickets, a lot of the Senate, because this is a triple witching. This is when term limits hits again. All of the House, Debbie Stabenow out. There's a huge election right around the corner, so I'd say to anyone in Michigan is, if you're mad, don't waste the opportunity you have in 24 months. Go out and get even, if that's your ilk.
I think there's also one other thing, which is that issues-based elections are seldom decided on a slate of issues, that it's not a whole bunch of things that people group together. It's usually an issue or a small collection of issues that are closely related. And if that's what matters to you, then maybe you need to decide what really matters to you.
What about,
and try and make that a priority.
What about this idea, though, that Matt Marsden, who's a Republican strategist, who's pushed some reforms or overhauls for marijuana reform in Michigan, what about the idea that, one of the really major things we saw in 2004, of course, was Karl Rove going out into some swing states and a lot of also just conservative states talking about issues like same-sex marriage. What about the issue that 2016 didn't have, particularly in Michigan, any ballot initiatives that might have gotten folks who weren't excited about Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, I think I mean more the latter, though, here, to the ballot to vote, and then, well, while I'm here, I'll vote for president. Was that just a complete, just bad idea that Democrats were not able to get something on the ballot to turn out folks in 2016?
I mean, you can look at both parties and say, why did neither party found an issue that would entice their voters? I mean, the election, I think it was wound up about 4.65 million voted in the end. It wasn't that far off. Maybe it was 50,000 or 100,000 less than come out. But it wasn't radically off from where presidentials vote. I don't know if there was really a ballot issue that would have changed that. So I think you can sort of play Monday morning quarterback and say, if we put this on the ballot, that would have happened, or if we put that on the ballot, this would have happened. Could it have enticed some voters? Yeah, but I don't think the turnout was so radically off that that would have changed
things. Ballot issues are another example of one of those things that maybe will have an effect on the margins, but it's not...
Well, like 13,000 votes in a state is a margin.
Yeah, fair enough, but... Usually elections aren't. This was the closest presidential race in Michigan history. Right. Most of them aren't.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Okay, we've got room for a couple more questions. Yeah.
My name is Bill. In this election, the false news industry is beginning to make Fox News look like a legitimate news source. There's a very wealthy town in Macedonia whose major industry... is propagation of false anti-Hillary news.
Run by, like, teenage boys.
They are wealthy. I am astounded. I've been engaged on Facebook trying to be very positive, not putting forth a position, but saying, no, that's wrong. Fact check this. Your information is wrong. But apparently I'm mistaken. Hillary Clinton has murdered personally somewhere between 3 and 18 people.
And then, Bill, you wouldn't believe what happens next. Just click on the link.
And number 7 is the most interesting.
Absolutely. So
shocking.
So,
and take this quiz to find out whether you will like the next quiz you're about to take.
I thought faux news was the death knell to our country.
I know.
I am shocked by what's happening now. And is there any way to bring this under control?
Well, as a program director of an NPR station, I desperately want to answer, but I'm going to give it to Jeff Williams, who put his hand up even before I could put my own hand up in my brain.
I want to go,
so Jeff, go.
To the wise words of the internet phenomenon Mark Twain, who said, quote, "A lie can go around the world before the truth can get its pants on." So, yes, things are happening faster. This has been going on in American news since we were founded. So there's just a faster pace to it. Is it right? Is it wrong? I don't know. But if Mark Twain was saying, you know, lies are around the world before truth has pants on, then I don't even know what he would say now.
Right. Oh. Rick, you looked like you wanted to jump in.
Oh, I could. Actually, this may be our next issue's an ale, that we could spend a lot of time in this topic.
Right, Steve? That's going to be our next one? Rick and I actually are talking to Steve about, and I have some concern about navel gazing, right? Spending an hour and a half just talking about the state of the media and whether we're doing a good job or not.
And I think that, you know, that's always kind of boring, but, I mean, if you talk to your family members and your friends who are not political, I think a lot of them were sharing articles and you would not really expect them to, because normally... they'd be sharing stuff about the Lions or about the latest blockbuster, but this seemed interesting, and Hillary killed people, so why not?
How many people are looking forward to family time at Thanksgiving this year?
And I do have to say, as the publisher of a legitimate news source, which my good friend Stu subscribes to and other people do, I feel like a moron because I'm clearly missing out on a great deal of revenue.
No, it's a definite danger in terms of not only fake news, but actually looking at the source of news, because people have so many sources to find news from that they don't differentiate where the news comes from. It could come from the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, or a blog, or a fake site, and a lot of people don't have the time to differentiate. One thing I'm encouraging, actually, is with the holiday season coming up, as some gifts, subscribe for some gifts to your relatives and friends and get them some news sources, because media is getting extinct. You're seeing the buyouts in Detroit. This is a scary time for this republic.
I will do this shout out that people we know at the News and the Free Press have just gotten notices that that they're asking everyone to take a buyout. And that's because of the economics of the industry. And I'm an old newspaper and wire service guy. If you don't, subscribe to a paper. That's probably one of the best things that you could do to try and deal with exactly what you're talking about.
So we've got about 2 minutes left. I love the idea of ending on the note of things that we can do that are positive. Let's do a quick lightning round. Jeff, from right to left. We're talking about some really heavy things, some scary things, though we've made it this far. How How good do you feel? I'm going to do a Tim Skubik on a 1 to 10, 1 being really negative, 10 being super positive, about the future of Michigan going forward under this Trump administration.
The election results were a surprise. We're a robust democracy. This too shall pass. And get out, get active, get loud.
Stu?
You know, I feel good. Regardless of the, when we were on November 1st, nobody knew who was going to win this election. I said, regardless of what happens, people are going to wake up the next morning. Some people are going to be happy. Some people are going to be sad. But we're going to figure out whoever wins, they're going to figure out how to try to carry their agenda. And whoever loses is going to dust themselves off and get engaged. And the one thing I'll just repeat again is buy some media for some friends.
Susan?
You know, I don't really know what to expect. I do think that, you know, there are some concerning signs. I'm not a big fan of the president-elect going after the First Amendment. I have, you know, a self-interest, but actually so do all of you. And I would not like anybody to do that. Personally, I don't think Barack Obama has had enough press conferences. But he's had them. I would like to see Trump do that. I would like to see him not attack protesters for exercising the right to assemble. I'm hoping that he's working through the kinks and going from candidate to president, but I don't know, because he spent all weekend attacking the cast of Hamilton, which was amusing, yet disturbing. I also am concerned about the myriad conflicts of interest that he has as a very powerful businessman. And it's up to those of us in the media to report on them, just like it was up to us to report on the Clinton Foundation and all of Hillary Clinton's potential conflicts. So even though we are a highly partisan country, even though a lot of our social norms have gone the way of the dodo, I think we still need to fight for some basic standards. And I'm very hopeful that Donald Trump will be a more conventional president and kind of leave some of those more autocratic tendencies that he exhibited on the campaign trail to the side.
Rick Pluta, co-host of It's Just Politics on Michigan Radio.
I'll just say that I can't get as lofty as you guys, but if we could find a way to pay for it, it's a hell of a great time to be a political reporter.
Thank you, everyone, for coming out tonight. I know there are a lot of intense and serious feelings about this election. I want to thank everyone again. As I said, you're the 0.00001% of folks who are coming out on a night to talk about politics.
You say that to all of the 0.00001% of the
I think probably some of the panel might be able to hang around and answer any more questions, because my guess is there are some more. And I will give a shout out quickly to my station, Michigan Radio, which is a nonprofit. Oh,
winner of a Murrow Award.
Can we give a round of applause? Is that Chad Livengood in the back there? Chad Livengood of the Detroit News.
At Lansing's hottest nightclub.
As we were talking about, you wanna do democracy a favor, go out and buy Wednesday's Detroit News, not only because there's going to be some great stories, I'm sure Chad will be in it, but also because of the Friday savings that Chad told us all about. but seriously, Michigan Radio, as a nonprofit and other news organizations, I can promise you that every single story, I would talk to any single person in this room about being fact-based, and our reporters go out every single day and do their jobs. Only 6% of the people that listen to Michigan Radio actually give. If you want to do something about that, you have the opportunity right now to do it. And this event is free, because that's our commitment to this kind of dialogue and what we believe is really, really important going forward. Thank you to Inside Michigan Politics, Susan Demas, Stu Sandler, Republican strategist, for coming out. Jeff Williams, along with Inside Michigan Politics, public sector consultants, the whole table in the middle there.
Public service sector consultants, spokesmodel.
And Rick Pluta, my co-host of It's Just Politics.
Zoe Clark, resident political junkie at Michigan Radio.
And one more thing, a big thank you to the folks here at Lansing Brewing Company. Make sure you tip your waitstaff well. And even though we're wrapping up, you can stick around and have another drink or two. And thank you all for coming out tonight.